Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Danielle Shlomit-Sofer, music theorist and musicologist who co-founded the LGBTQ plus music study group. We're talking about the book Sex Sounds, Vectors of Difference in Electronic Music. Good evening, this is Mark Lynch, and this is Inquiry. My guest tonight is Danielle Shlomit-Sofer, music theorist and musicologist who co-founded the LGBTQ plus music study group. And we're talking about the book Sex Sounds, Vectors of Difference in Electronic Music. Danielle, welcome to the show.
Hi, Mark. I'm delighted to be here. Thanks for having me.
I want to say this: there are parts of this book that, if you don't have a somewhat knowledgeable aspect of music, it could be a little bit tough. But there are other parts. I strongly recommend everybody try to read this book. But I want to begin with your acknowledgments. I've never seen an acknowledgement section that began with "to all you haters." And don't take this the wrong way, I actually fell off my chair. I was laughing so hard. But
that's the impression I wanted.
No, it was serious though, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, you start off by saying that the book is very technical. And the reason for that is that initially when I proposed the idea to folks, they thought, oh, this must have been done somewhere before. Huh. Why would you talk about sexuality and electronic music? It's such an old topic. But in reality, nobody actually has gotten into the nitty-gritty of all of this music, and so.
So nobody was able to bring up the book that had that information to you. No, somebody somewhere must have had it.
Well, it hasn't been published yet. Yeah, I imagine that they had a lot of problems publishing the book, like I did.
Well, the interesting thing, the most important thing about this book is that it really addresses sort of missing parts of the history of electronic music, and especially in relationship to LGBTQ plus communities and communities of color.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Talk to me about that. I mean, was it hard to research all this information?
Well, you know, I started with a very small group of composers. I was looking at electroacoustic music, which is the fancy name that they give to music that's taught in the university by professors and composed by them and their students. And I had this idea that I would be looking through this music for sexuality because it's supposedly an area that doesn't exist in this music, because this music is supposed to be different from what you hear in the mainstream, in the radio, and on TV and in the media. It's not supposed to have a beat. It has these very strange sounds you've never heard before.
Yeah.
It's more socially proper and that kind of a thing. And so I set out looking for music that was improper in that genre, and realized I had a bunch of white men.
Kel surprise.
Yeah. Well, no, it was kind of surprising because I thought, okay, in the history, they must have been erased. Let me look for these composers. And sprinkled throughout, there are composers now, people of color. Toru Takemitsu is written electronic music and things like that. But actually, overwhelmingly, it still remains a very white, male-dominated profession. And I started to research, why is that? And what's the difference, actually, between this music that's gated in the ivory tower and the stuff that we hear every day?
That's a long haul, man. And that's like a lot to try to bring through this book, but you do it. I want to say that for the benefit of the audience.
Thank you.
For the focus on the music, you focus mostly of music since 1950s. Why?
Well, that's around the time when electronics really took hold. That's when people started getting tape machines in their house, or that they could have and use, or at least in more available spaces. And studios, radio studios mostly, started exploring, well, what can we do with this recorded sound? Not just recording music that existed out there in the world, but creating sounds that we never heard before and calling that music and making what's called a soundscape, or sort of an imaginary realm that people could make sense of that was in the virtual world.
Now, there's been a lot that's come out within the last 10 years about the role of women in the early days of electronic music and the critical role that women played in that, like Derbyshire and other women like that. And also, electronic music was used pretty early on in film. And I was thinking of Forbidden Planet.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So, Danielle, when did you get personally interested in electronic music?
Oh, wow. Well, it was quite a long time ago when I was maybe 6 years old and I had a tape player in my house, double deck. And I would just tape things off the radio and then see if I could play them forward, like fast forward and backwards, and then unwind the tape and do all kinds of things like that. I didn't know that was electronic music, but now I'm pretty sure that's what it was.
It is. It is exactly what it was. And it's funny, certain people have that impulse to just mess around with stuff, and then that's how you get your sort of gateway into electronic music.
Yeah, I think that's the whole premise of the book, is just messing around with people.
How difficult was it to find the participation of other voices in electronic music? Because as you mentioned before, and I totally get this, the history that's passed down from professor to student is typically old white guys, and especially old white guys from Europe. How ferreting all that other information out, how difficult was it?
Well, I really had my head against the wall for about 6 months thinking that where are these people? But then, of course, it's so obvious when you say, wait, let's look at the radio. Let's listen to the radio. There's pop music. There's hip hop. There's all these genres, funk, that go back a long time. And, you know, now, of course, as you mentioned, there are a lot of histories coming out that, actually, Pierre Schaeffer's studio in Paris was not the first place to record sounds, but there were people doing that in Egypt and in Ghana over the world, and as early even as the 40s, the 30s. And a lot of the research focuses more on the militaristic history rather than an aesthetic history, and that also causes a divide there.
Wait a minute, a militaristic history of electronic music?
Yeah, so for example, you have Leon Theremin, who created the theremin.
Yeah.
And that was originally supposed to be a surveillance system that would sound when people walked near something. And instead, it wasn't successful, and eventually he developed it into the instrument it is today, and that's the sound that you hear on the Forbidden Planet soundtrack there.
Now, one of the things that's fascinating about your book is, from the beginning, you're asking questions about electrosexual music. First of all, we should define what electrosexual music is.
Yeah, so, I mean, usually when I ask people questions about electrosexual music or sexual music, I ask them, well, what does sex sound like? And people hear all these sounds in their heads, and then I say, but, okay, are those the sounds of music? Are those sounds that we actually hear in music? And no, those aren't the way that it's usually represented. Usually you have some woman's voice, either laughing or moaning, and that's the representation. And so electrosexual music focuses on, first of all, electronic components, so separating sight from sound. So what we hear might not be anything that could be performed in the real world. That woman could be moaning for 20 minutes,
right?
Like Donna Summer.
And we'll talk about that later. That's a great chapter.
Yeah. Or it could be music that pulsates and builds rhythm, like Ravel's Bolero,
right?
And people attribute that as sexual. So it's a socialized thing. It's not that music sounds sexual by itself, but that people from different places hear sexuality in different ways. And that's what I was looking at.
And that's really an important thing to think about, is that how you interpret music has everything to do with who you are, where you're from, all sorts of things. And what your, how you define what your sex is. Immediately broaden up the range. I mean, people, when they think about electrosexual music, are probably thinking of, as you mentioned, Donna Summer. They may think of music like the Serge Gainsbourg and what's her name doing Je T'aime, which, you know, and there were all these rumors that when that was going on that she was having an actual orgasm while they were...
She's not that one.
He did record with Brigitte Bardot. It's Jane Birkin.
That's the one. Yeah.
That's the one. But that's what I think people have, as you mentioned, and you talk about in the book, there's a very male definition or concept of what electrosexual music is. And that definition may be really different for people with other defined sexualities.
Well, yeah, I think for folks who aren't part of that heteronormative, patriarchal, social mechanism, we might view especially that kind of interaction as the opposite, as a turnoff, because we hear...
That's right,
because
it sounds like... It sounds like the oppressors are having sex in your ear, which would not be a good thing. So you're defining... So this whole thing... And you use terms here that I can't say that I really am familiar with because they're musical terms. But the pulsating telos of repetition is important. And it's a very masculine, aggressive. Now, as you mentioned in the book, when we talk about pornography, for instance, males are very visually oriented, where women are more complicated.
I wouldn't say that that's necessarily the case. Okay. I would say that's how men are marketed sexuality.
You're right.
Men are marketed visually to look at things in a certain way, but also men are represented visually as thrusting, as doing all these things, and they're not audible. Whereas women are the object of the look, and they are sonic. So it's a marketing ploy. It's not necessarily that's really what turns everybody on, but that we're socialized that way.
Exactly right. Now you have a history, and you talk about different pieces in this book, many of which I've never heard of before, and I found that fascinating. Going back, I'm a person who's actually taught courses on Dadaism, but I'd never heard of this person, the German Dadaist Erwin Schollhoff, and his Sonata Erotica.
So he, in recent years, he's one of those composers who was forgotten, and he died in a concentration camp, and he was Jewish, and he pled allegiance to Soviets, and so he had all these issues that cost him his life. But he was, first of all, the person who did a silent piece before John Cage, and also he had this Sonata Erotica that it carefully notates a woman's orgasm from the beginning to the end, and after that, she also douches on stage in front of everyone.
That's the Dada element right there.
Yeah, right.
Was it ever performed?
Oh, yeah, you can go on YouTube, and there's lots. Actually, there's a few performances of it.
Oh, wow. But there's so many other pieces in this book that I found your discussion of fascinating. But I want to zero in on two artists, because we're going to run out of time, because I could talk to you forever. I want to talk about Donna Summer's Love to Love You, Baby, 1975, co-created with Giorgio Moroder.
Yeah.
There's so many interesting problems with this that you unearthed that I thought it was really important to talk about. There was this whole mythologizing Donna Summer as the sexy Cinderella because of this song. And it was all the credit goes to Giorgio Moroder for the person who sort of, you know, took her stuff and then manipulated everything. And then he was the one that... Talk to me about that, because I found that really interesting.
Well, I mean, their stories completely differ on how the song came about. He presents it as this situation in the studio where it was very intimate between the two of them. He kicks out her boyfriend. He says that she imagined him as a joke, but, you know, his jokes fall flat a little bit. whereas she talks about how she ran into the studio and had this song in her head that she couldn't get out of her head, and she sang it to him right away, and he recorded it. And so she gave him the melody of the verse and the melody of the chorus, and that's what he started with. And so what he did was he was a sort of a glorified studio musician. He just added tracks to that. And the singers talk about how Donna Summer was never in the studio with them.
Right.
And he gives a story about how she never was really in the studio. She just came in and left. But anybody who's seen Ariana Grande, for example, recently do her studio recordings, she didn't have to be there. She could just lay the track down within 5 minutes. She would say, again, 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 yep, and do the recording and leave. And he needed to set it up because she had the idea for the song.
Now, how did she feel about being characterized as the sexy Cinderella?
Oh, she hated it. She despised it. She fought it her whole life. Some people say that she became religious because of it.
That's right.
I don't think that's necessarily true. She came from the gospel.
That's right.
From gospel singing and from the church, and that was her history. And then she moved to Germany, and she made it big as a theater star, and that's when Marauder met her. So she was already on her way. She didn't want to come back to America. She didn't want to go back to the life that she had before, but he took on all the credit.
Now, you expand this in that chapter, and I found this really interesting because I was a rock DJ at that time, an alternative rock DJ, but the whole disco era. There was a whole... And I, at the time, I thought it was ridiculous and sort of weird. There was all this criticism of disco at the time. It was equated with simplicity. And the whole vehement, I mean, the thing that they exploded disco records on a ball field and all that stuff. It was interesting that the audience for disco music, where they had a definite gay fan base and a lot of African-American women. And you can't help but interpret that anti-disco thing as being racist.
Yes. Yeah, for sure. I mean, I won't claim to be the person who talks about this first. There is a long discourse talking about this. But the way it ties into my book is this question of the telos, what you talked about before, the drive, the pulse to climax. And that was actually the whole reason. One of the aesthetic reasons that rock fans lashed out against it. Oh, how can you have this pulse, four on the floor, this driving, incessant beat? And that's the same thing that electroacoustic composers still claimed, some of them still today, that separates electroacoustic music from this kind of pop music. But in reality, there is no boundary like that. First of all, there's a lot of rock music that drives four on the floor.
Oh, yeah.
And electroacoustic music is now trying to get new listeners because it's a dying art. And so they're trying to figure out a way to attract people. And this is how the beats are coming back. So you have this kind of DJ aesthetic coming in. And so even though it was dismissed and in a sense, we've taken out the women, we've taken out the people of color, we've taken out the black music element because it's all these white guys presenting on stage these black aesthetics.
You're right. There was also this interesting, and it still exists today, criticism of electronic music as, and this is a quote from your book, a kind of lazy redundancy. It's not actually music. You can just program it, therefore it's not music. And there's this really interesting negative connotations that people put on electronic music.
Yeah, and it goes back to the tape era, too. So people would think, oh, you can just, you used to cut and paste the tape, but still today you can copy and paste on a computer. And they think that's how music is made. You just copy and paste all the buckets, and the computer does the rest.
That's a comment you hear about hip-hop today. I have people I know who, are hard rockers, and they will refuse to listen to hip-hop. And I don't get it. It's like, it's some of the most interesting lyrics in the world are being written in hip hop. And how can you not listen to it? First of all, how can you not listen to all music anyway? But to sort of sit, and it's that whole thing being repeated from the disco era. It's that.
Well, and what's interesting? I have a research project I'm working on right now with producers in Seattle. And, like, for example, Sir Mix-a-Lot, he was really into MIDI and programming synthesizers and sequencers, and he knew all the ins and outs of the electronic equipment he was using. So you think of him as a one-hit wonder, but actually he influenced the entire region in terms of
that's
kinds of equipment he was bringing.
Wow,
and he was doing, he was DJing Saturday nights at the YMCA and bringing people to this kind of electronic aesthetic. And so that was still continuing throughout. It just... it had to change because of laws that were being made against gathering and teen dance ordinances, which were happening all over the United States. And so also the rap music wasn't allowed on the regular pop charts.
Do you play? Do you do music?
Yes, I play piano and viola, and now it's more electronic, but yeah.
You do? Do you have any pieces recorded?
Oh, well, yes, but they're not out there in the world.
Okay. I was just curious. You have some wonderful chapters on one of my favorite artists, Janelle Monáe. Ever since she started recording, I always thought she was so unique and fascinating and really interesting. And so you write a lot about her aesthetic. And this is where something like I really regret not having a musical background. You talk about something called the wobble warp.
Yes.
And maybe it's like because I'm an old guy. I keep listening and I'm not sure I'm hearing it. How would you describe what the wobble warp is? I love that word, by the way. Did you make that up?
No, I got that from an article by Terry Baton, who's a journalist, and she was writing about The Satisfaction, which is a group from Seattle, and it was a kind of an aesthetic in their music. So you can hear it a lot in their music. They do it every few seconds. I was trying to figure out other music and what their influences were, and maybe they drew on something. And I found this song from a lot earlier, from 2013, where Janelle Monáe she sings a melody, and then when she gets to the downbeat, instead of hitting the note that you expect, she kind of does a neighboring note to it. She sings a little wobble on it. And it's very brief. It's a hesitation. And I do say in the book that some people may not hear it, and it's open to... It's only open to those who have experience with this genre, with this music, and hear this in a lot of different styles of music. So that's why, not in the Janelle Monáe chapter, but the later chapter, I provide a chart of different songs that have this feature so that maybe people could pick up on it elsewhere.
And I'm going through those as we speak. But you also write about that, is that it's sort of a queer black aesthetic signal that can be read by people who know about it.
Well,
code is what I'm talking about.
Yes, it's coded in the sense that any of these aspects are coded.
Yep,
I mean, like I said before, when you hear the woman's moaning, you might get turned on or you might not, and that's a code that you're reading and hearing and responding to. And in this sense, it's not that you could hear this one song and that one moment, it's only about, I would say, a second and a half, and then know, oh, right, that's what it is. But it's that you recognize it and hear it as an association to other aspects. So she doesn't just land on the downbeat and just wobble, because that would have just been an ornament, which we know from music from at least the Baroque era. But she rises in a certain way in a scale,
yep,
and then she skips a note, and comes back to that note later and then wobbles on that note. So she kind of ornaments the missing note, the gap. And it's a gap fill, what we would call in music.
But does this wobble warp have a sexual aspect to it?
Yeah, of course. It's a tease. It's
okay.
Because we have this repeating figure throughout the song several times. And every time we have the gap filled by the note on the downbeat, it comes very easily. We expect it. There it is. But that one time, she doesn't fall where we expect it to fall.
Huh.
And she changes up the harmony and emphasizes that in a way that makes us feel like a lurch, like, oh my goodness, what happened? And that feeling of, oh my goodness, what happened, that lurch, that eccentricity, that's a kind of a queer aesthetic. It's kind of that's not quite normal.
Well, wait a minute.
And that's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Now, you also mentioned, we're going to run out of time. There are several pieces. Alice Shields' Apocalypse, 1994, is an electronic opera. Can you just talk about that for a little bit? Because I found your description of it amazing, but has it ever been performed?
You know, so it has never been performed, except now there are performance plans in place.
Oh, wow.
I was in touch with the composer, but it is an outrageous piece that I'm going to have trouble describing.
Well, I was going to say, I read an entire chapter on it, and I was left with, holy crap, I need to hear see this.
Well, she has a CD that she released that's just like synthesizer sounds, her singing and belching. And and it includes, so there's a supposed to be a woman, and then there's a plant in the audience who she calls out to. And then at the end of the opera, after she comes to this big reawakening, this spiritual reawakening, she ends up trying to have sex with Shiva, the Indian god, who has been ripped up and then recreated into a two-foot penis with balls the size of grapefruits. And there's like a light show and all kinds of aspects I'm leaving out. It's in five different languages.
Wow. I mean, I can understand why it's never been performed. It seems like it's incredibly complicated.
I would say so. I think to make it seem realistic in the sense that audiences will pay attention and continuous and seamless, yeah, I think it's difficult, but I think people will enjoy it even if they don't understand everything that's going on.
Now, she cast herself as the three major roles: the woman, Devi, the seaweed sea goddess, and Shiva.
Yes.
Now, is she still alive?
She is. She's alive and well in New York City. She's performing all the time, composing. Yep.
So, is she going to perform in this production of this piece that's coming up?
I'm not sure, but as I kind of said in my chapter, my conclusion was that the reason it hasn't been performed is because she has taken too many authoritative roles in the piece and that it would be very difficult for another artist to come in.
Oh,
but
God.
I think another company is actually going to put it up. And so I'm not sure if they're going to be using the recordings that she's supplied, which I think is hard to interact with, or if they're going to sing and bass the new performance off of the recording.
Oh my God. We've only scratched the surface, and I mean that, of this very complex book. My guest tonight has been Danielle Shlomit Sofer, music theorist, musicologist, who co-founded the LGBTQ+ music study group. And we've been talking about the book, Sex Sounds, Vectors of Difference in Electronic Music. Danielle, it's been a real pleasure.
Thank you. I was happy to talk about the book. Everybody read more.
You're right. Everybody listen to that. You're listening to WICN 90.5 FM. This is Inquiry. My name is Mark Lynch.